empty means empty, doesn't it? Well, Nobel Prize-winning physicist and MIT professor Frank Wilczek says that when it comes to space, the empty areas are actually filled with activity, a dynamic grid constantly creating and destroying particles. Frank Wilczek's latest book, The Lightness of Being, brought him to the show earlier this year, and we're playing that segment for you again now. I started by asking him if we only called empty space empty because we didn't know it was filled until recently.
Yes, I don't think we realized fully until well into the 20th century, really the last part of the 20th century.
So
that space is a very, very dynamic medium full of spontaneous activity and many different kinds of structure.
Wasn't it called ether until Einstein's theory of relativity eliminated the need for such a medium?
There were primitive ideas of space being filled with some kind of material in the 19th century that Einstein kind of swept away. But in a deeper sense, Einstein told you what the properties of an ether had to be, not that there couldn't be an ether. And in modern physics, that very idea has really come in a modified form to dominate the way we think about fundamentals. So really, the fundamental object in modern physics is space itself and the particles, matter, as we normally think of it, us, the stuff you study in chemistry, is really a kind of epiphenomenon, ripples on top of the activity in space.
And there's a grid. Is it the grid your concept?
The grid is my name for it. Because I thought the old idea of ether has so much baggage that we needed a new name, and so I call it the grid.
Well, grid is a term that's usually is commonly used by urban planners and artists. How does it apply to something as chaotic as the universe?
Well, I thought of using Matrix. But
there was a movie.
There was a movie, and the movie was quite good, but the sequels were horrible, so that spoiled it. And I thought of using Borg, but that also has connotations I didn't want to give. So grid was the best I could come up with, a nice one-syllable word that has many of the right features and kind of gives you the right images.
But you're not inventing something that other scientists haven't already been talking about. You're just putting a name to
what
a lot of people have been talking about.
Yes, I'm synthesizing ideas that many people have contributed to, and including my own work.
And this is an area that we really can't see. This is all stuff that we have to prove without being able to observe.
No, we can observe it. We don't observe it, of course, in the normal course of everyday life.
Well, it's black.
What's that?
It's mostly black, isn't it? It looks empty.
It's empty. It looks empty, right. But our senses are very incomplete. We don't see, for instance, the radio waves that our radios pick up and that we're broadcasting right now. But with the proper instrument, namely a radio receiver, you can find this structure. And that's a deep property of modern physics, is that in quantum theory, to see something, you really have to actively intervene in its motion, its activity.
We're intervening in space?
And to see the deep structure, you have to, in a sense, create it. You have to supply enough energy in a really small space to see this structure. So it's there in our equations normally, but to see it as actual material, we have to very actively intervene by building accelerators or to concentrate a lot of energy in a small space.
So what we're doing is duplicating on Earth, because there's no way we can intervene with something that's hundreds, millions of light years away.
Oh, I'm sorry. By space, I mean everywhere, not just
our own
outer space, but also inner space, including even the interiors of our bodies. This activity is everywhere.
So it's all the same? The rules apply? I have empty space or the grid in me?
Absolutely. You have the fluctuating fields, the constant fields, the little density that fills the universe, the dark energy. It's really everywhere. And these structures are the primary reality in modern physics. As I said, matter, including you and me, is kind of an epiphenomenon on top of it.
Well, you've been working on some new ideas about matter and mass, haven't you?
Yeah, well,
I mean,
there's new and there's new. So
you say that mass is not always conserved, which is...
No, mass is definitely not conserved.
Didn't Newton tell us it was?
Newton told us it was, but the idea that mass is not conserved really started with Einstein in about 100 years ago with his idea that mass could be converted into energy. And energy is the more powerful concept. Energy really is conserved, but mass can be converted into different forms of energy and lost and changed into other kinds of mass or energy.
Although my high school science teacher still told me that mass could be conserved.
Yes, well, it's an amazing thing that's I think one of the truly startling, profound coincidences, pieces of luck, profound facts about the world is that the idea that mass was conserved, which Newton used and Lavoisier used to found modern chemistry, and is very accurate for many practical purposes, at the most basic level is just completely wrong. Like at an accelerator, like the Large Electron Positron Collider, LEP, or the LHC, which is its successor now, you start with a certain amount of mass, make a collision, and out comes 30,000 times as much mass. So you convert energy into mass. So the conservation of mass is not just a little bit wrong. When you get to these other more extreme conditions, it's completely wrong. And the ultimate in that, which I think is one of the most beautiful things, and I'm especially fond of it because it comes out of my own work, is that we can understand the origin of our own mass in terms of essentially massless building blocks. The quarks and gluons which build us have practically zero mass, and the gluons have strictly zero mass, and yet following the laws of physics, we can calculate very accurately, very precisely, and very fully in a beautiful mathematical theory where our mass comes from.
This is counterintuitive in the same way that quantum mechanics is counterintuitive.
It builds on quantum mechanics, in fact. So, yes. So to really understand where mass comes from, there's no avoiding it. You have to use quantum mechanical ideas and a very unusual mind-enriching palette of ideas that seem fantastic, and yet they all come together to explain very concrete facts about reality.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, who is winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics. He's written a book called The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces, published by Basic Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You say that Newton's law of gravity works in practice, but not in theory. So
yes.
Newton, did Newton get anything right?
Well,
he was one of the greatest minds in the history of the world, wasn't
absolutely.
He?
Absolutely. Well, Niels Bohr had this concept that I'm very fond of, which is profound truth. An ordinary truth is something whose opposite is a falsehood. A profound truth is a statement whose opposite is also a profound truth. So any fool can discover a truth. It takes a genius to find a profound truth. And Newton did what was possible and fruitful for his time. For his time, it would have been premature to worry about mass changing into energy and vice versa. It would have been impossible to go all the way from scratch to our modern theory of gravity, the general theory of relativity. So he found sort of intermediate theories that were adequate for the experiments of the time and were fantastic achievements for their time.
And they work.
But we've gone beyond. Physics goes beyond.
But right? we have the theory of relativity,
yes.
And we have quantum mechanics,
yes.
And they both work as well. But nobody's been able to reconcile the two. So see a time when we'll disprove them in the same way we've disproved Newton?
Well, we have actually in the last 20 or 30 years succeeded in putting together special relativity and quantum mechanics. And that's led to very rich insight into the nature of mass and the so-called standard model or core theory that I describe in quite a bit of depth there, and ideas about how to go further in unification. What we don't have yet, and may be very difficult to achieve, is a theory that unites general relativity, the theory of gravity, general relativity, not special relativity, with quantum mechanics.
Isn't that the goal of string theory?
That is the goal of string theory. But part of the problem is that the conditions in which you expect quantum phenomena in gravity to be important are so extreme that they're very difficult, in fact, totally impractical to access experimentally. So we're not getting a lot of guidance. And even if we had the right idea, we might not be able to test it or prove it.
Well, right now, you've been talking about the feebleness of gravity. I always
yes.
thought of gravity as a very powerful force. It keeps our solar system in place.
Well,
keeps me on the ground.
Yeah, you might be surprised to hear that gravity is feeble if you are working very hard to lose weight by climbing up and down stairs or something like that. But and it's not feeble, of course, in astronomy where it becomes the dominant force. But when you get down to the fundamentals, you get down to elementary particles, you know, protons or electrons, and the forces that determine their motion, gravity is ridiculously feebler than the other interactions. The electrical force divided by the gravitational force between a proton and an electron is 1 followed by 40 zeros, you know, an unimaginably large number. So the electric and strong forces are much, much more powerful as basic forces at the atomic level between elementary particles than gravity is. The difference is that electricity has positive and negative charges, whose influence can cancel each other. So if you make big blocks of matter, they tend to cancel each other out, and you have neutral electricity, and so the electrical force is small. But gravity just adds and adds. All mass exerts positive gravity. And so it just adds and adds. So when you get to really big bodies, eventually gravity comes to dominate.
So it's a cumulative effect.
It's a cumulative effect.
It's weak, but add a lot of it together and you got something really strong.
That's right. So it's weak. It's fundamentally weak, but it keeps going. So the meek inherit the earth, so to speak.
And when did we discover that? Is that a fairly recent notion, the feebleness of gravity? I keep on thinking back to my science classes, and I'm really disappointed with Mr. Johnston. I think he didn't do a good job.
Well, it's really a 20th century phenomenon, because it's really only in the 20th century that we realized that there are such a thing as elementary particles, so that you had an absolute measure of where the basics are and what you should count as weak and strong. If you only look at big objects, then you can't make this comparison in an unambiguous way.
My staff will ask quite reasonable question. How can you add two things that have no weight and get something with weight?
That's because mass is not conserved. Conservation of mass precisely means that when you take two objects with mass A and mass B, the total has mass A plus B. But in fundamental physics, mass is just not conserved. So what's conserved is energy. So if you have what's basic is energy, and if you have a lot of things moving around very fast, that energy is in a confined space that is manifested as difficulty of moving the whole thing, or can be also associated with the whole thing having mass.
What do you expect?
Now, that might sound like just a curiosity that might happen in principle, but in fact, that's the origin of most of the mass of matter.
And that's the way the world works,
whether
I like it or not.
That's the way the world works, and that if you're unhappy with your weight, that's what you have to blame.
Yes. Joe from New Jersey wants to know if virtual particles are photons, and if so, could one ask what wavelength that they would be?
Well, there are many different kinds of virtual particles. You can have virtual photons. You can also have virtual neutrinos, virtual gluons. Any kind of real particle also exists in a virtual form. And they can have any wavelength. They can, some are more probable than others, but in principle, fluctuations of all kinds can, of any wavelength and any energy can occur.
How much can we learn from this Large Hadron Collider at the CERN laboratory near Geneva? You seem to have figured most of it out already.
But I might be wrong.
So this is going to confirm what a lot of physicists have been proposing, hypothesizing for a while.
I think there are some very exciting ideas that I've been pushing now for 20 years or so that are finally going about unification of forces and sort of reaching the next level of understanding in fundamental physics that will finally be tested at LHC. We've been waiting and waiting and waiting. Now we're going to have the tool that really allows us to examine these questions. But the ideas are somewhat general, and so there are details that are completely unclear to me, and as far as I can tell to anyone else, that will need filling in. And I said details, but they're actually very big details. And also, not everyone agrees that the whole picture is right. So, in science, nature is the ultimate arbiter. So it comes to another level when nature speaks. So I'm very eagerly awaiting that happening at the LHC. It's just the right machine to address this. And, I anticipate a new golden age of fundamental physics coming.
We'll get
out
to
of
that.
This. Yes.
But haven't string theorists been hoping that this will prove string theory? Could it?
Well, no, I don't see how it could prove string theory because string theory is so vague. At present, people don't know how to solve the equations of string theory with enough detail to make any concrete prediction. There could be developments coming out of the LHC that would encourage people to think more about string theory and guide progress in the subject. But since there are no real concrete predictions, I don't see how it could possibly prove it.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, who's the Hermann Feschbach Professor of Physics at MIT. He won the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004 for work that he did as a 21-year-old graduate student. His latest book is The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces, published by Basic Books. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Frank Wilczek. His latest book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces, published by Basic Books, a title that is a nod to a very wonderful novel.
And movie.
Right. Is that what inspired you?
Yes.
To come up with that title?
Oh, absolutely, right.
Now,
it's also very fitting because, as we've already mentioned, a major result of my own work and modern physics as a whole is that we understand that light and matter are really not two different things. They're really just one thing that is more like the old concept of light, I would say, than the old concept of matter. And also concretely that we build up the mass of normal, ordinary matter, the stuff that we're made out of building blocks that are essentially zero mass.
And now that's pretty much accepted as scientific
truth. Oh, that's absolutely accepted, right? Otherwise, I'd have to give my Nobel Prize back.
Now, I was reluctant to bring up the concerns some people have about the LHC creating a black hole that yes. will destroy the world. But and I'm sure I know your answer. No, it's not true, because you've called this Hadron Collider, you've compared it to the Great Pyramids of Egypt, which would mean that you think only positively about them. But why do you think that people have even come up with that idea?
Well, I think, well, there are highly speculative ideas in physics that, although highly speculative, are quite respectable, that would suggest that you could produce very, very tiny black holes at the LHC. But where people go wrong when they hear that is in thinking that very, very tiny black holes are similar to really, really big black holes. It's as if you had heard that there were something called elephants that could trample you, and then learned that people were producing mini elephants or and that were as small as amoebas and were still worried about getting trampled. They're just very, very different objects. The kind of black holes you might be produced at the LHC would be smaller than an atom, much smaller, smaller than a proton, would exert gravity less than a small grain of dust, and also they're highly unstable. They live a small fraction of a second. So when you get down to it concretely, what people refer to as a black hole at the LHC in these theories is really that in a violent collision between protons, instead of the stuff taking 10 to the minus 24th seconds to come out, it takes about 10 to the minus 20th seconds because it's held up a little bit by gravity. Now, so nothing to be afraid of. Plus, it probably doesn't happen.
Gravity is weak. I'm afraid that it's gravity may be too weak to save us.
Right.
One of the things that scientists are looking for in the LHC is the Higgs particle.
Yes.
Now, why is it important for us to find that? This is at this point,
yes.
We pretty much accept the fact that it exists, but we have no way of proving that?
No. Not everybody – well, it's very the details are very unclear about what the Higgs particle is or whether it's a particle at all. So I think it's kind of unfortunate that people talk about finding the Higgs particle as if that's the goal. I mean, there are many particles. Why is this one special? I think the right way of thinking about it is the following. Our established equations of physics, the so-called standard model or core theory, I call it a physics, has embedded in it, at its kernel, the idea that what appears to us as empty space not only has fluctuating fields, but also has some constant fields. So it's as if we're fish swimming in an ocean that slows us down. And if you think about fish swimming in an ocean, they might tend to take the ocean for granted. You know that's just the way the universe is. Until some very clever fish, after some evolution of science, figured out that they could get a more profound description of the world by saying that actually we're swimming in this thing called water. And then maybe they'd want to investigate microscopically what is water made out of. And eventually they'd find impurities and lots of interesting structure and atoms and so forth. So that's kind of where we are. Our equations tell us we're swimming in a kind of ocean that slows matter down. But we don't know what it's made out of. We know it's there. It appears in our equations. But we don't know anything about its atomic structure. So we don't know what it's made out of. And that's the simplest guess is that it's made out of one new kind of particle. I should say that no known form of matter is a possibility. That doesn't have, none of them have the right properties. So the simplest possibility is to introduce one new kind of particle. That's called the Higgs particle. But I think other possibilities are certainly viable and even prettier than for other purposes.
So we may discover all sorts of things that nobody's even imagined up to this point.
Yes, almost certainly, because nothing that people have imagined is pretty enough to, none of it has the ring of truth, I would say.
You keep on saying pretty because scientists believe that yes. the whole thing has to have a certain kind of a beauty. Whatever happens, what would happen if somebody finally came up with the true unified theory of everything and it turned out to be a really ugly equation? Would scientists doubt it?
Yeah, I think we're almost in that situation. We have this core theory that describes all the experiments that have actually been done with tremendous success. And, you know, experimentalists are highly motivated to try to poke holes in this. There would be Nobel Prizes, you know, for fun discovering something essentially new. So we have this theory, but we're not satisfied with it basically for aesthetic reasons. It's based on having four different kinds of interactions, strong, weak, electromagnetic, and gravitational. The setup is kind of lopsided.
It's a little messy.
It's messy. The details are messy. So the next level, this golden age of physics that I anticipate, will enable us. I mean, we know ways of making it prettier by enlarging the equations, and we're going to find out if those enlarged equations actually correspond to reality, if the new effects that these equations have really occur in nature.
It's interesting that you're talking about a golden age starting, because a few years ago, a physicist wrote a book in which he said, we pretty much know everything we need to know. This, that from now on, science is just a matter of tying up some of the loose ends.
No, that's pretty ignorant, because if you
try to remember his name, but
it's probably the kind thing not to. It's possible that it's certainly possible in principle that we would get there where we have a theory that's really, really good, maybe has some loose ends, but describes everything. And we don't see a clear way to improve it. But we're nowhere near that stage now. We have brilliant questions like, what is the dark matter that astronomers have found? Are the equations really that look so lopsided really just because we haven't filled in all the sides and seen the underlying symmetric, beautiful structures? These questions are ripe. And
a listener wants to know if these theories can, since we're talking about our bodies as well as space,
yes.
can be compared to cancer cells and might have medical uses.
Well, I don't see at the moment how the most advanced, the kind of super advanced concepts in physics that we hope to explore at the LHC, these more speculative ideas will have practical applications, but who knows? Since we don't know yet what's going to come out, we don't. But in that spirit, let me say, not 21st century physics, but the related 20th century physics has now very much become practical. In the 1930s, fundamental physics suggested the existence of antimatter based on essentially aesthetic ideas, in fact, trying to put together quantum mechanics and special relativity. You found you needed antimatter, and that was subsequently discovered. So-called anti-electrons or positrons are now used in medicine. PET scans are positron electron tomography.
So what was theory first,
right?
Then actually winds up having a practical use.
Exactly. And there are similar stories with muons, and people are trying to use particle beams for certain kinds of cancer therapy. The magnets that people develop to study fundamental physics have turned out to have medical applications, and the computer technology and so forth. Yeah. So it's a great investment mostly in unanticipated ways.
My guest is Frank Wilczek, the winner of the Nobel Prize in Physics in 2004. His latest book, The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces, which is published by Basic Books. When will the LHC be fully operational? It's going to take a few months, isn't it?
If all goes well, it'll take a few months, right? We just passed a milestone, which you may have heard of, got quite a bit of news coverage, where for the first time a beam of protons was put in this 27-kilometer ring and went all the way around, and then another beam in the other direction, but not both at the same time.
So there hasn't been a collision yet.
There haven't been any collisions, although the beams were dumped, of course, and, you know, plowed into piles of rock, and the world didn't end.
How long will these machines operate? Have they been given some kind of a? We've had other colliders, for example.
Yeah,
are they still being worked with?
Some have had very long lifetimes. So, if I had to guess, I would guess at a minimum the LHC would operate for 15 or 20 years with upgrades, but it depends very much what happens.
You say that only 5% of the universe is normal matter and that the other 95% is dark matter and dark energy.
Yes.
Weren't these things also initially proposed to explain the inexplicable? How did we get to the point where we know 5% and 95%?
Yeah, well, just as we were finishing off this core theory that I mentioned of normal matter and kind of patting ourselves on the back for a job well done understanding existence and matter, the astronomers restored our humility for us by discovering that things weren't moving the way they're supposed to.
They were moving faster than anybody thought. The universe was expanding.
Right, and the gravity didn't seem to be adequate to be holding them in the orbits that they have. And so at first, to great skepticism, they introduced the concept of dark matter as a way of saying that, well, actually, there's more matter than of some new kind that's doing this job. Over the years, more and more refined observations by a variety of different techniques, so not only looking at objects orbiting, but looking at how gravity gets bent, looking at how something called the cosmic microwave background and its distortions. That's a long story, but in any case, several different experimental probes of what's going on have all converged on a consistent picture that there's some new kind of matter that's not made out of quarks and gluons and electrons and photons, the things we know well in normal matter, made of something fundamentally new that interacts very, very weakly with ordinary matter and makes up and contributes in total over about five times as much to the mass of the universe. And we have some guesses for what it is, some good guesses.
Well, you won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of asymptotic freedom in the theory of the strong interaction. I was going to ask you to explain that, but we now only have about 30 seconds to do it, and I think it'll probably take longer than that.
Well, there are four forces: weak, electromagnetic, strong, gravity. I figured out the equations for the strong force.
The book that we've been talking about is The Lightness of Being, Mass, Ether, and the Unification of Forces. It is published by Basic Books, and I want to thank you so much for stopping by.
Thank you.
It has been a great pleasure to talk with you.